You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey everyone, new episode of Sex Gets Real is starting now. I've been getting so many messages about my chat with Ruby Bowie Johnson on last week's episode and just the realness and the just awesomeness of Ruby and our conversation about polyamory. So thank you to all of you for writing in and sharing your delight. I love hearing from you. I've also been getting a huge influx of questions from all of you about so many different types of things, from stuff around jealousy and fantasies to marriages and queerness. So there's going to be an episode very soon of me fielding all of your questions. I also got an email that pissed me off. So definitely expect to hear a little soapboxy rant about that. But this week's episode is with Wendy Strugar, who is the founder of Good Clean Love, which is one of the most successful body safe lubes on the market right now. She has so many years of offering advice around love, marriage, and sex. She just wrote a book, which we will be talking about in this episode. And I just want to give you a heads up. Wendy has tremendous experience, and she is doing really rad things in the world. She also is very cautious and skeptical around things like hooking up and living out BDSM in dungeons and kind of putting yourself into sexual situations that lack meaning, where there isn't care present. And you will hear her explain her experiences and perspective in this episode. And I think you'll also hear that there's some nuance to that around, like, care can look like friends with benefits and pickup play, but there has to at least be some vulnerability and shared respect in that. There's also a funny little part where we're talking about fantasies, and she talks about how, you know, the fantasy of being hit can be really hot, but actually living out being hit isn't so great. And so I just kind of want to offer, as always with this show, me and the experts that come on are sharing our experiences, our beliefs, and your lived reality might be different. I personally love getting flogged. I love the little sting of a whip from time to time. Sometimes even a little riding crop situation that gets me squealing. For me, sharing that with Alex is like the epitome of trust and vulnerability and getting present in my body, a place where sometimes it's somewhat foreign to me. And so the actual act of impact play of experiencing that adrenaline and that pain and letting him see me in that place is like deeply connecting and definitely an act of like trust and connection. But that's not true for everybody. So we get to have our own stories and our own perspectives. Wendy has some beautiful things to say about monogamy and passion. We've been hearing a lot lately on the show from polyamorous experts like Andre Shakti and Ruby and Reed. And there's a lot of you listening who are consciously monogamous by choice. And I think that there's some really harmful myths and stories, not only in the world, just kind of with mainstream Hollywood, but even within sex positive circles and sex positive educators, kind of poo-pooing monogamy or looking down their nose at it. And so I think it's really important that we hear Wendy talking about how she has maintained tremendous sexual pleasure and maintained a really intense sexual connection with her husband over the years, because I want you to hear that having a rich rich fantasy life and tons of variety and loads of passion in a long-term marriage that is monogamous is absolutely possible. It's absolutely normal. It is absolutely accessible to all of us. And so for anybody who is monogamous and has been feeling a little unseen or left out, I hope that you'll feel some inspiration and joy in hearing what Wendy has to offer. It's a really fun chat where we talk about lube and we talk about connection. We talk about what being sexually responsible actually looks like and how it can actually be a really tough place to be, and most of us aren't really ready for it. So I think it's going to create lots of thoughts and feelings. So let me tell you just a little bit about Wendy and then we will jump in. But first, a quick reminder, please don't forget to support the show on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/sexgetsreal. You can pledge as little as a dollar. Every single dollar helps. I adore all of you for supporting me. I'm getting ready to start those monthly group calls where we practice communication skills, where we practice emotional intelligence, where we level up together so that we feel less lonely around the things that are really difficult and scary and challenging. So please also check out the show notes for this episode. I would love to have you on the group calls. People are already enrolling. And of course, Patreon supporters at a certain level get free access to those group calls. So all kinds of juicy ways that either we can work together, you and me, live in these awesome group calls with this powerful community, or just support the show to help me keep doing it. So Wendy Strugar is the author of the New York Times praised book, Sex That Works, An Intimate Guide to Awakening Your Erotic Life. She's the founder and CEO of Good Clean Love, a pioneering organic intimacy product company, as well as a relationship expert. She's written for over 10 years on the topics of love, sexual health, and positivity, and we are going to jump into this week's episode now. Welcome to the show, Wendy. I am ridiculously excited to have you here to talk about your book, Sex That Works, and lube, and passion, and all the things. It's wonderful to finally have you on.
Dawn, thank you so much. I'm so excited to have this time with you. Really grateful.
So where I want to start is something that actually made me squeal with joy when I read it. And it's that Jane Fonda actually sought you out to help consult on the show Grace and Frankie.
Yeah, that was quite the little Hollywood drama episode in my life. So, you know, I learned a lot actually about Hollywood drama by being in this for a little time. But one of our first investors, who is really a rock star in her own right, one of the founders of Code Pink, mm-hmm. Jody Evans. I mean, she is really a force to be reckoned with in the world. And so she, of course, hangs out in Hollywood in L.A. with all the people and, not surprisingly, friends with Jane Fonda. And so she was at a party and kind of mentioned, and you know, if you know the themes of the show, mm-hmm. you know, they were really looking for some information just about how does somebody start a business like this and how do you have these hard conversations and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so, like, out of the blue, I get this email from Seymour, and that's actually the email she uses, Seymour something. And, you know, this long, long email, you know, like really long email, you know, will you help, end of the email, will you help me love Jane? I'm like, what? Yes, Jane, of course, I'll help you. So we emailed back and forth for quite a while. And I would like come to dinner. I'd be like, guess who emailed me today? And people would be like, and you know, my kids don't even know who Jane Fonda is, right? So, it was definitely a generational thing of like, who knew, but it was really fun. And we sent a bunch of products to her. And then I was going down for, I do a lot of meditation work. And so I was down at Joshua Tree. And so we arranged at that time so they brought me in, gave me like a VIP pass, and I met with all of the writers and Jane and Lily. And, like for about 3 hours, kind of just talked about my history on developing a love company and lubricants and what I know about vaginal health. And it was, you know, you love a captive audience, right? Mm-hmm. People who actually really care about what you're saying. It's like, there's nothing better than that. So it was really just a super rewarding time. So we took some photos. And, you know, keep in mind, no NDAs or anything with this. Mm-hmm. And we took some photos with me and Jane and Lily. And I don't know if you saw one of those photos, but I could send you one. And Jane and Lily are like, oh, like Lily actually said something to me. Like I said, you know, thanks so much for doing this work. It's so important. She's like, are you kidding me? You're the one doing the work. I mean, they just said really dear things like that, you know, and they were so just like people, just like us. So the following week, I happened to be on some silly morning show in Oregon. And I mentioned that I had just been there doing this, and I shared the photo with them. So anyway, then of course the studio made it more of a thing than it was, what TV does. I'm traveling and I get this call, you know, hold please for Martha, whatever her name is, the creative director. And, you know, and she just like went off on me. How dare you? You know, on and on. And I'm like, listen, I didn't sign an NDA. No, they told me I could use this photo on social media, mm-hmm. which is exactly what I did, you know? And so that was the beginning and the end of my love affair with Jane and Lily.
Oh, no!
They actually said that they would review the book. Both of them said that they would love to see the book and that they would write in it. And then after that happened, you know, fair weather friends that they are, you know.
Aww.
I mean, here's the thing about the Hollywood people is that, you know, when you can help them, they're all about it. Mm-hmm. But they're not really about helping us.
Yeah.
You know, unless it's a lot of money,
yeah.
you know. And, you know, it's unfortunate. I think it's one way that we separate ourselves yet again from this, you know, this is how we create this celebrity culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess in my own way, I sort of participated in it. But I was glad as I was watching through season 3 that some of the things that I had shared with them kind of showed up in the script.
Oh.
And so I had a little bit of gratification that I influenced in some ways.
Yeah. I'm just like so excited by that show. And I'm sorry you had that experience because like, I love that.
It's fun. It's exciting.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
It is. And like, I love even more now knowing that some of what drove that story about like older women and vibrators and sex and pleasure and thinking about things like arthritis and like that you still of course want to have amazing pleasure in sex and tackling issues of like, you know, sexual orientation and marriage and to know that like part of your story is a part of the show. And I think that's so exciting.
Yeah. You know, it's subtle. Of course, you know, when you get things like that, you sort of wish your brand will show up on a shelf or something
mm-hmm.
because, you know, we know that those women need lubricant to use that vibrator, but that somehow didn't make it in. But, you know, we know that's true.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I do like the show. I watch it. I also watch through the season and I think that they do a lot of really extremely bold things, just in terms of what does sexuality mean and how does it continue to influence us as we age. And, you know, so yeah, that was a little fun chapter in my own story for sure.
Oh, I love it. Well, so you have been creating this beautiful, product Good Clean Love now for a number of years, and your second book Sex That Works just recently came out. You had your launch party a couple of weeks ago, and I had a chance to read the book and of course check out people interviewing you about the book and all of your amazing work. Good Clean Love is definitely a product like I've recommended on the show in the past, and
definitely I started Good Clean Love because I was married for about 17 years at that time. and necessity was the mother of invention. And I had such bad reactions to the petrochemical products that my doctors would recommend that I knew if I gave up sex, I would probably be giving up my marriage. And I grew up in a divorce and didn't want to do that. I had four kids at that point. And so, so that's how I became devoted to trying to develop products. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really for me.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I would never have guessed in a million years that I'd get so good at chemistry. So, as I am,
well, I'm really glad that you brought up the reaction that you were having to the petrochemical lubes, because I know I have had some pretty painful reactions to lubes over the years. And this was before it was a lot more common and available to be able to get natural lubricants and organic products and things like that. But
yeah,
a couple of months ago, I had Sarah Miller on from Smitten Kitten, who's been doing amazing.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She's amazing.
Yeah, she's remarkable. Her study and writing on isoosmotic lubricants is for sure the best in the industry. I send it to people as a point of reference. So she really did her homework in a big way.
Yeah, and I know that like one of the things that is important for people to know about lubes is that, you know, bacterial vaginosis, which is a really, really, really common thing for folks with a vulva, you know, a disruption in the bacteria, and that lubes can actually not only increase the risk of having bacterial vaginosis, but also when you have untreated BV, it can increase your chances of acquiring and or spreading STIs and what a lot of people
HIV.
HIV, exactly. And what so many people don't realize
60%,
is like,
actually.
Which is huge. That's like a huge number.
So first of all, Dawn, hallelujah, praise the Lord. This is the first interview I've ever done when my interviewer is telling me the things that I usually tell the interviewer. So, you know, you are incredibly accomplished and really, really thoughtful. And so, yeah, that whole thing that you just went through is the education that we spend so much time doing with physicians nationwide, and really helping them to understand that osmolality is actually one of the primary, maybe the most primary feature that you need to think about when you're giving a lubricant or using a lubricant in an office or for sex. And there is this, you know, really, it's like many studies show up to a 13 times risk of a single use of a highly concentrated petrochemical lubricant is enough to give you BV. So a single use, up to 13 times risk. And then when you have BV, like you said, you know, most women don't know what it is. They've never heard of it. 84% of the time it goes undiagnosed. And then they're 60% more susceptible to much more serious, HIV, STDs, you know, so it's really a very significant health risk. And to the degree that you have this imbalance in your vaginal core, which is really what BV is, it's kind of like that low grade sore throat, you know, you kind of know something's off, but you know, mostly maybe there's this weird odor, but we don't know what it is. But it's the same way as like when you have that kind of bacterial imbalance in your gut, it's just not possible to be fully well when you're walking around with an imbalance like that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a way in which we don't have a lot of language or understanding for just how profoundly impactful the nature of our sexual health is for our overall well-being.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that, you know, what I see in the work that I do, and I know you've certainly encountered this because you've had so many opportunities to like answer questions with your advice column and your radio show, is that shame drives people to make poor consumer choices.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, it drives us to all kinds of bad choices, right? Like not just at the shelf, but yes, you know, our collective sexual shame is, you know, I always say that if we solved only one problem in the world and it was sexual, we would by consequence solve almost all the others, because the degree to which we carry this darkness that shrouds what is really like a survival need. I mean, after you eat, sleep, and drink, the next thing that we are is sexual human beings. And so to the degree that we suppress that and suppress it, and it's shrouded in darkness of our shame and fear and all the things we can't articulate, you know, it just creates a lot of anger and other kinds of emotions that would resolve if we could just be sexually satisfied. So it's pretty tragic. And I think that in most places, consumers, the average consumer anyway, tends to go towards something they know. Mm-hmm. There is the innovative sort of end of the spectrum consumer. But what we find on shelf is that, you know, once people have exhausted the standard brands and kind of come away with the same itching and burning, you know, Good Clean Love is such a friendly looking product on shelf that we, because we're a small brand, we don't really have the money to do major advertising like KY does or whatever, but people will grab that. And also I think doctors giving those samples out at offices makes a huge difference. But you know, the repurchase rate on that shelf is generally nationally 1.5%. But our repurchase rate is the highest in the industry at 25%, which tells you that, you know, those petrochemical products, people won't buy them again. They'll buy them one time, but there's no reason to go back and get it again. Usually they end up in the garbage. But our products, you know, people come back and buy over and over again. So I'm really grateful for that. I'm so grateful for that.
Well, and I think that one of the important things to just for people who aren't very lube literate yet, or they're kind of new on their journey. You know, for me personally, when I was 18, 19, 20 years old and just kind of going to that little dark, you know, corner sex shop that had all of the toxic products, because that's all I knew at the time. You know, I would buy lubes, try them once or twice, not really like them. They'd either get sticky or they would burn, and I would just kind of like stick them in a drawer. And then I ended up with multiple products that just never, ever got used. I think you're so right. Like, now my relationship with lube is that when I find lubes I love, like, I zoom through those bottles, and it's something that I enjoy using.
That's because you're sexually healthy. You know, that's because you're sexually healthy and you have, you know, some regularity in your sex life. But, you know, it's not uncommon at all for us to sell a 4-ounce bottle of lube, which is by far the best value on the shelf also. But, you know, for some people, they could have that bottle for a year or two, mm-hmm. you know. And so they might keep following me in a column or on a show or whatever, but, you know, they don't need to buy that product again. Mm-hmm. So thus, you know, I'm giving away my commercial secrets. We're making our Karagold lubricant, which is a CBD product, in a 2-ounce bottle. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever tried the CBD stuff, but I'd love to send you some.
Oh, I would love to try that.
Yeah, I live in a cannabis state. So I, of course, was like compelled to actually try to see how I could make that work in sex. Mm-hmm. And we get some amazing testimonials of women who've had some very significant vaginal traumas who have found an amazing amount of resensitizing and pleasure again. Mm. So that's so heartening for me, when you put your heart into something, you don't really know if it's going to work exactly the way you hope. And then you find out, in fact, that it did. So there's a doctor in St. Louis actually who found out about it at, and she has a pain clinic at St. Louis University, and she's going to start giving it out to some patients. So, you know, for me, this is like really the heart of what I love about working and doing what I get to do at Good Clean Love, which is like really trying to make real solutions for real people so that they can have access to just the healing benefits of sexual pleasure. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the same thing that drove the book and made me reveal so much more of myself than I ever thought I would.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, there was a couple of parts of the book that just like made my heart sing with joy and resonance, because it was so much of what I like talking about on the show. And I know a few minutes ago you were talking about emotions, and I spend a lot of time talking about the importance of cultivating and practicing emotional intelligence within our relationships, and that, you know, it really takes courage for us to name our feelings, to not push them down, to experience them. And that was actually a really big part of the book, the importance. You kind of started with it and ended with it of like, you have to be able to feel all of your feelings, including the ones that are scary and hard to sit in, if you really truly want to tap into bliss and ecstasy. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about your journey with that.
Yeah, you know, so the introductory chapter is called, you know, is about learning to feel. And if I'd had my way, that would have probably been the subtitle of the book, because the truth is just what you said. I mean, there is no such thing as relationship without emotional intelligence, which tells you why we are so culturally impaired relationally, you know, that we don't really value. And many, many people grow up without any, just like you said, basic identifiers. Okay, so, you know, my kids were growing up. It's like, okay, you feel frustrated now. Say, I feel frustrated because, you know, that's a language you learn. And many people never learn that language, you know, or I'm sad, or, you know, I'm angry, or I feel afraid. You know, I mean, you know, we just don't have fluency in a lot of that. And so for a lot of people, they resort to a single emotion. Like my father used to just have rage, and no matter what his emotion was, the only thing he could really express was rage. And it's like what you said, you know, if you can't feel that entire range of emotions and you cut yourself off from the negative ones, like fear or grief or, anger even, then you think you can selectively filter out some feelings, but that's really not true. What you do is you cut yourself off from that whole range of feeling, and what gets most impacted is your ability to want to want. Mm-hmm. That deep sort of libido desire is at its very core sort of our most profound longing for expression. But you can't have that if you won't feel the rest. So, I mean, that's the first thing I say in the book. And the last thing I say is feel everything. Because, you know, that is like the beauty of what we get in this life. You know, it's messy. You know, my son, I have four children, and my third child has just turned 21 and just fallen in love for the first time and then just had his heart broken not long after. We don't know where the story is going to end, but, you know, it's like the range of emotion is so intense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, overwhelming. And I'm like, it's great. This is like teaching your heart to feel. Yeah. You know, you become more competent. But I don't know where this message got sent out that somehow if you feel these feelings, your heart can't bear it.
Yeah.
Your heart will break. No, it's actually the reverse. It makes you more courageous. Mm-hmm. It makes you more capable. And I was telling him, you know, an old friend of ours who passed away gave me this book about the history of love. And, you know, in the Middle Ages, when affairs were different, you know, because it was all that courtesans and all this weird stuff going on, you know. But the goal was falling in and out of love. That was the exercise, mm-hmm. you know, that they knew that they would fall and fall deeply, like Shakespearean. But that the idea wasn't that we stop trying, that we cut ourselves off from the experience, but rather that each of those times we become a better lover. Mm-hmm. Right? So and I just feel like this whole young generation has all but forgotten how to fall in love. This is the time to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I know I'm old, and you know, I'm trying to learn how to Snapchat now. I got some intensive lessons in snapping this weekend because, you know, because I'm so bad at it, but I just am so trying to get that message across to young people that, you know, and I just had an interview yesterday where this guy, Zach, who has this show at No Filter, was saying how he just has this Tinder sex all the time, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm like, you know, he's like, what advice would you give me to have this kind of sex with feeling? And, you know, the guy is the most feeling guy in the world in his everyday life. And I'm like, just risk bringing that part of you to this, mm-hmm. you know, and so, you know, so that is, there's a whole chapter on courage that's early in the book. And I think that I think it's really important. And I'm so grateful that you are constantly beating that drum about that real intimacy is the most courageous thing we do.
Yeah.
You know, there, you know, it's not just about taking off our clothes. It's about bearing our heart. And, but that, I mean, that's like where the magic is.
Yeah.
That's actually where our lifeblood is. And so, yeah, I hope if people take anything away from that book, that they will be able to learn to trust that part of themselves mm-hmm. and persist in it, because it's not a one-time gig, right? It's not like you're just courageous one time and then, okay, on to the next thing. You know, if you want to love somebody, you know, I'm in it for 35 years, and I just want to tell you, I have a therapy session this afternoon because I have to keep trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You don't get there. There is no there.
Yes.
You just try to make a cleaner relationship to the people that you dedicate your life to. Mm-hmm. And those relationships are not disposable the way we often think of them. You know, I'll just find somebody else. You know, when you invest huge parts of your emotional capacity in somebody, you know, those are resources that are available to for decades to come if you're smart, mm-hmm. you know, and we so like throw those away as though, oh, that's nothing. But it's not nothing. It's everything.
I totally agree. And, you know, part of my own journey with kind of feelings and emotions was I spent so much time being so scared of rejection, of what others would think, that I literally cut myself off from pleasure, from being seen, from really being connected, because I was just constantly trying to do the dance of avoiding the things that I didn't want. And all of my energy was spent in the avoiding and very little in the mm-hmm. just experiencing and being present. And, you know, what I've continued to learn, because you're right, it's like there, you don't arrive, you just keep trying, is, mm-hmm. you know, the more that I'm willing to just have the really awkward conversation, the more I'm willing to just say that thing that feels super scary and kind of move towards the, mm-hmm. you know, or even like grief. I had to grieve the stories I'd been telling myself and that maybe they weren't true. And I'd lost all these years to that. And to move through that is where I started finding these really deep connections with my body and with sensation and with a partner. And it's scary as heck, but you know, the more I've done it, the more I realize like, it's not that it gets less scary. It's just, I know that on the other side, there's something other than the fear. And I think that's so important.
Yeah, and don't you think that like our social media mania mm-hmm. totally feeds all that, right? Like, yep. you know, I mean, you know, it's like we're all like in a fishbowl. I mean, I don't really do even my own social media, you know, admission. I mean, every now and again, I'll post something on my page, but like I want the real thing, mm-hmm. you know, and I, you know, it's like such a weird space because, you know, promoting a book or, you know, I know these people who literally spend their lives self-promoting. And it's just so exhausting mm-hmm. to be like thinking, you know, am I gaining something here? Yeah. You know, there was a super interesting article on in the New York Times on Sunday about how popularity makes us live longer. But they make this very interesting distinction between being truly likable as opposed to having the status of numbers and, you know, like, stuff, you know, that people count on social. And it's like the status part never makes you feel better ever, you know, but being liked, really, truly being liked actually is the thing that makes you healthier in every way. And so, so I think that's the discovery, you know, like where you were saying, you know, it doesn't get less scary. I think actually, Dawn, you'll find over time, you just know that you're going to get to a place that feels so much better.
Yes.
When you just are authentic. Mm-hmm. So that it's like the discomfort is just part of this journey.
Yes.
You know, it's not the block. It's not the closed door. It's like, okay, this feels really hard to say this thing, but you know, it's like that authentic self-expression. That's the only way to a real relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's also the thing that feeds sex most. Like when people self-disclose and they actually really have sort of shared their fears or their traumas or their whatever it is, it's like that is fuel. That is the fuel that combusts and alchemizes into sexual passion. And so when people just don't, they're not willing to share that, you literally have nothing to feed the fire.
Yes.
So, so yeah, that's why, you know, my book, I think about Sex That Works, is different than most books because, you know, to have chapters themed curiosity or courage or sensation, it's like you could talk about that about almost anything, not necessarily just sex. But the truth is that as you move towards those places sexually, you do it everywhere in your life, mm-hmm. you know, where you stop saying no, you know, and getting over this rut sex that so many people get into, you know, when they just keep having the same sex over and over again because they're afraid to try something new or they're afraid they won't do it right or whatever. You get this stuck with this leftover sex, what's left over, you know, and then, but if you consider just coming to that moment the way you were when you were a kid, where you were just curious. Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder what would happen if I put my finger here. You know, you wonder that and you do it, you know? And so I feel like I just try to encourage that kind of freshness or freedom in our sexual space, in our sexual discovery and exploration.
That's actually something I'd really like to talk to you about. I've had a number of non-monogamy and polyamory experts on the show and also lots of questions from people who are curious about trying group sex or threesomes or moving into polyamorous situations. And I also get lots of questions from people who say, like, we've talked about it, but we've decided monogamy is really for us. So now how do we keep the passion alive? And I think there's a lot of myths out there that marriage equals the death of excitement when it comes to sex. And I know your experience has shifted from one of sex really not being a source of inspiration or pleasure to being in a long-term monogamous relationship that's filled with passion and amazing pleasure. And I'd love it if you could talk a little bit to the people who are in long-term monogamous relationships and want to kind of stoke that fire. Like, what is your advice for that?
Yeah, so I first want to say that I think that there's a ton of books that would lead people to believe that monogamy is akin to sexual death.
Yes.
You know, Esther Perel does it. You know, this guy who wrote Sex at Dawn does it, you know, and all these things about how monogamous relationships, you know, just there's no way you can keep them passionate. So either I'm like a super weirdo or that's a bunch of bullshit. Because, you know, and I want to say that a lot of times also many people begin their relationship with this really hot sexual fire and it kind of peters out. Whereas, as you said, and I talk about in the book, my sexual relationship was not that, I mean, it was not that good to start and it just grew over time. So maybe I did it like backwards or the right way or something, but I don't believe that monogamy is sexual death. In fact, what I would say to you is if you really are in, and even leave the word monogamous out of it, but if you're in a deeply trusting, intimate, vulnerable relationship where you have the courage to actually have conflict, which means you're not trying to become like the other person. That's another thing that happens frequently in long-term relationships where people are conflict averse. And so they give up what is really unique about them so that they're more like the person they're with. And that alone will kill passion because you lose the essence of what makes you different and attracted to each other. So that's pretty common. And my husband and I never did that. And it did make for continuous conflict. But also we have really great sex. So, so I think it's a fair deal. My husband's very different from me. Like a night and day different. He's a psychiatrist. So he's a really good listener and not much of a talker. And I am a very serious talker and have learned over many, many years to be a better listener. Although my children would tell you still that I'm not that good a listener. I'm trying, but, you know, so if you bring, like I was saying to you earlier, your true emotional content and disclosing what it is that is, that makes you tick most deeply, and you are not afraid to really be yourself in that relationship. And you're also, this is the biggest key piece, I think, is that a lot of people, when they get into a long-term relationship, and I've heard people say this to me, believe that their partner should be responsible for their sexual satisfaction.
Oh, yes.
So this is actually the kiss of death. And I talk really early in the book about sexual freedom, and that sexual freedom really at its height is an individual taking responsibility for their own sexual needs. Mm-hmm. And so not to confuse this with sexual license, which mostly is how people think about sexual freedom now, that, oh, they can just swipe right or left and have sex with whoever they want. That actually is just a means to a lot of really painful erotic traumas, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, we can say whatever we want, but, you know, having sex with somebody who doesn't give a shit about us and probably won't remember our name is not good for our erotic soul. And, you know, I'll go down and you can put it on my gravestone as saying as much. I've seen it do really serious damage to a lot of young people. And I always tell people when I give them my product to not waste it on somebody that they don't love in whatever form they love that person. I don't really want to participate or support sex that's just this sort of biological activity, because that's not what sex is for. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to have good sex that way. So anyway, sorry, distraction, getting back to what you were saying. But you know, in long-term relationship, when you are responsible for your own sexual health and your own sexual needs, that means that, for instance, you don't hold your partner accountable for being a certain way to make you feel sexy. So it's not like they have to say X, Y, or Z or bring flowers or pick up their socks in order to make you feel sexy. And that you also have your own comfort level with what feels good to you, that you can articulate or at least move someone's hand in the direction of what you know from your own experience is sexually satisfying for you. Yeah. So, you know, I had a woman say to me once, well, why would I masturbate? That's his job. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my God, please, can we have a conversation about this? No, it's nobody's job but yours. Your sexual pleasure is yours alone, and nobody gives it to you. That's a gift that you share with people when you want to, when you feel safe, when you actually feel like you can get to the rawest part of yourself, you know, and then your fantasies start to unfold. It's like you never have the same sex twice.
Yeah.
But that's not going to happen to you if you're waiting for somebody else to do it to you, except maybe when you're 16 in the back of a Chevy van. Mm-hmm. Then you might have that experience. But let's not mistake that huge cascading of neurotransmitters for what sex should be.
Yeah.
Because that's not what sex is. And I think that kind of fallacy, you know, we have all these stupid romantic comedies that make sex look like that. Oh, let me rip your clothes off and let's kick the seat over and, you know, oh, you know, and it's like, it's just happening to me and I can't help myself. And if it doesn't feel like that, then maybe I should take a pill, mm-hmm. you know, or something to make me feel like that. No, that's teenage sex. It's not grown-up sex. Yeah. Grown-up sex is when you are driven by your own desire to desire, mm-hmm. and that you like to touch yourself, or at least are not afraid to, and that you are not afraid of your own fantasy life, that you'll let that unroll in front of you, which is a huge chapter in the book. I don't know if you read it.
Yes.
It was actually the hardest chapter to write. But I think it's actually a place where many people's monogamous relationships come apart. And that is really an individual's fear of their own sexual rocket fuel, mm-hmm. not what somebody else is or isn't doing for them. So I just said a million things just now.
Oh my God.
And I'm sorry yes. that it all came out like that. But
it's okay.
But this is what happens when I get going about sex. So,
I am so excited you brought up so many of the things you did. Like I think the freedom chapter was one of my favorites because, I've been doing some courses with marriage therapist Terry Real, and some of his work talks about how most of us move through life in an adapted child phase, which is, you know, psychology terminology. Mm-hmm. So basically, we never learned how to be functional adults because we're not in a world that values that. And so adapted child is kind of like pretending to be a grown up, but not really having words for emotions and seeing things as very black and mm-hmm. white and kind of like taking rather than sharing. And so much of what you were talking about was kind of this adult stepping into your adult sexuality means taking responsibility and not placing blame. And that can look like I'm setting this boundary or I'm stating this need that I would like to have met. And it also means like exploring yourself and understanding yourself and being able to articulate that, because people I've noticed are terrified to actually articulate their experiences and sensations for that, like fear of rejection and being seen. But like, that's where the good stuff actually is.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So bravo for you. Yeah, there's not very many grown-ups in the room usually, and it's hard to grow up. Yeah. I mean, the truth is that it's not like it just like you turn 21 and then you're a grown-up. I have adult children, and I want to tell you that growing up happens far into our 20s. And in my own memories, you know, I was pretty much an abandoned child in a lot of ways. I grew up in a very violent divorce before anybody divorced in my hometown in New York, Long Island, and I lived a very isolated life, and my biggest fear from the time I can remember was always being alone and being excluded somehow, which is really like one of our most human fears, right? Because we know that the people who were thrown out of the tribe didn't survive in the day, right? And so it's that idea of belonging or inclusion is actually the thing that drives social media, right? That is what that whole business is about. But, you know, in our most deep personal life, you know, of where we live, literally live, you know, that takes grown up stuff to do that, to work through and hold, like, you know, with all my kids leaving, I might even start to cry now. You know, I'm often in tears of letting go of those really intimate relationships, probably the most intimate relationships I'll have in my life. But that's the idea. They're supposed to grow up and go on. And now I have to deal with this terror I have of living alone again as a 55-year-old adult. And it doesn't feel that much better than when I was 23.
Yeah.
That's the truth. I have more skills with it. You know, I have more like backup and capacity. But the deepest parts of what it is that frightens me about that, that's the same. So if you're not willing to do that work and you hold other people responsible for it, you know, you're just pretty much taking yourself out of the game. You know, and I always say to myself and my kids that there's no way around. There's no shortcut. There's only through, you know, that's all there is that you actually feel these feelings. And, you know, I remember being 20 or 24 or whatever, and being really on my own in the most profound of ways. And feeling like if I felt these feelings, they would kill me. Like I would just die. They were too big. And what you learn over and over again from feeling is that No, actually, all your body wants, and I talk about this in the attention chapter, is for you to watch it. Mm-hmm. Just witness this feeling. Just say, oh, Wendy, I see that you're really sad and feel really alone right now. And then, like, what? Let it happen. And then you move on. Mm-hmm. The next thing happens, you know? And I think actually for many people that takes a whole lifetime to learn. It seems for me, it's going to take me my whole life.
Me too.
Yeah.
So something else you
There's
mentioned.
There's another thing.
Oh, you go.
Go ahead. I just want to say that you know, when you were talking about that class you took with that sort of adaptive childhood, you know, I've met and interviewed a lot of people much smarter than myself. And one of the things came out of this idea about this container of relationships. I don't know if you remember that part of the book where, you know, when you stop worrying about your needs being met, you know, and you worry about what does this relationship need?
Yes.
It's like really weird how everybody's needs get met mm-hmm. when you're actually feeding this container instead of constantly like keeping score about who got what they wanted.
Yes.
Like everybody gets what they need. Mm-hmm. And that was not my idea, but I love that idea. So I talk about it a lot in the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's like a grown-up thing, right? And you know, certainly having children, I think, really kind of demands that you do that when you're trying to make a family. But, you know, even for a family of two, it's the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I love that so much. This, I think that we are in a time where hyper-individualism is being highly prized and valued. And there's certainly something powerful to people who are in marginalized or oppressive situations to actually be able to say, like, I am my own person and I deserve these basic rights. And I think we can put an and there instead of a but. And when we're in relationship with people, I think you're so right that it's me and it's you and it's us. And when we really truly decide, and like this is friendships or business relationships or intimate relationships, but when we really decide like our connection is a priority and how do we feed that, it creates so much strength for like all three of the relationships versus if I just focus on me, that often ends up taking away from you and from us.
Well, I mean, the thing is that I think that whole hyper-individualism, the way you talk about it, is just another defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. And again, I would say that that's fed by our social media, digital, sort of no attention for the moment kind of life we have. Because we all really, it's like, we're supposed to be more connected than we've ever been. And I think that never has there been a time on the planet that more people are alone.
Yes.
And we are a herd species, you know, and so it's not good for our collective mental health. And I think that even speaks to the politics of the day and how we could arrive at this very fractured, extremely fractured time. Because it all starts with the personal. And so it is true that it's whether it's a business or a friendship or an intimate partnership, you know, when you both come to it and say, what will it take for this container that's holding both of us to thrive?
Yes.
That is such a different question than what is my needs right now?
Yeah.
What do I want from you? Right. And, you know, because truthfully, sometimes it has nothing to do with what you want. You know, actually, usually it has nothing to do with what you want. And I remember, again, you know, my children have always been my best teachers. And, you know, my son was like, I don't care. I don't want to do it. And I'm like, who cares if you want to do it? It's not about that. You know, like, it's like, you know, this is what is in front of you to do. Mm-hmm. So like, have the life you chose. And so I just feel like we think about things so backwards sometimes that we don't act on our own behalf often, especially in relationship and sex. Right. Because, you know, women over and over again in college, post college will have these relationships. They can call them friends with benefits. They can call them, you know, Tinder swipe, I don't give a damn what you call it, you know, that they end up feeling so empty after, you know, so depressed after they give the most beautiful, tender part of their body to somebody who doesn't care anything about them, and then wonder how they could feel so bad. Why isn't that freedom? Because it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, freedom is actually demanding someone to care for you, take you to dinner. You know what I mean? Get to know what color do you like, you know, whatever it is. And then maybe you make out with them. You know, this idea that like sex is the marker about whether I would have dinner with you is insane. That is like collective insanity, you know? And I just can't wait till it reverses itself and becomes in the right order again, because we'll all be much better off.
So I'd love to talk, you mentioned briefly a few minutes ago, fantasies, and that is something that, I've encountered in so many different iterations in this work, of people feeling ashamed of their fantasies, not knowing how to share it with someone because they're afraid it'll end the marriage. But the thing that I find most interesting is I've had a number of women, both as clients and as listeners of this show, who say, I don't have any fantasies. I've never had a fantasy. Or if you ask them, like, what do you fantasize about? They say, nothing, I'm boring. And the fantasy chapter in your book is beautiful. And actually, one of the things I love so much about you talking about your own experience is how you keep a lot of your fantasies to yourself and allow that to fuel you instead of feeling like you have to share all the things with your husband. But for people who feel like, God, I don't know, I don't have fantasies, or, you know, I don't even know what that's like, what would you recommend for people to just kind of start opening a little bit to that like erotic landscape that lives inside themselves?
Well, that's such a complicated question. So there's a couple of things that I would say. You know, on the most surface level, what we know is that our sexual organ that actually holds fantasy and actually turns on our arousal mechanism is in our brain. It's conveniently co-located with our olfactory bulb. So, you know, that's why when you go out and you smell summer for the first time, you have all these incredibly rich memories of being 3 years old and smelling the summer, right? So memory, sexuality, and emotion are all co-located with our ability, with where we smell things. Some very interesting research about people who lose their sense of smell and all the things that go with that. So anyway, so actually using scent in your sexual encounters, you know, scents that turn you on actually will help you build those pathways that will help you access where fantasy is. So in my mind, fantasy is right behind that space, right? So your arousal mechanism, and it's almost like drawing back this curtain, of where those fantasies are stored. One of the things that I think is super interesting in that chapter, and really I feel like saved my life in a lot of ways, when I started to look at my fantasies, and this was in my 40s before I stopped suppressing them, you know, because I would have little things come up and I would think, oh, fuck, psycho. And I would just really work hard to shut them down. And so what I want to say is that when you're working really hard to suppress your fantasies, so much so that you might say, I don't have fantasies. That doesn't even exist in me. I want to say that the chances that those women are orgasming are very small, because you're using so much energy to suppress and the anxiety around fantasy that it's very hard for your brain to surrender to the experience. So that was my experience anyway, that there was this moment where I just said, okay, I'm just going to let this come. I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm just going to watch it and I'm just going to see what happens, mm-hmm. you know? And it was really courageous. It felt very courageous at that moment. And I was freaked out. Like, you know, I don't want to go too much into detail, but just suffice to say that none of my fantasies are politically correct or appropriate. You know, they all have to do with serious forms of submission and domination, which is why we were also fascinated by 50 Shades of Grey, by the way. Yeah. And in roles that, you know, that we collectively agree are wrong, but that have existed since the beginning of time. So I'm not arguing in favor of pedophilia. I feel like many, many people, we, you know, this is an entirely different interview we could have. But the percentages of people walking around who've had inappropriate sexual touch at inappropriate ages is astronomical. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that those things exist in our collective subconscious is not at all surprising, right? It's happened since the beginning of time, since humans walked on the earth. And, you know, now we say this is bad, this is wrong, but we also, it lives, it just is, you know? And so when you see that come up in fantasies, it's extremely alarming. And you start to think, oh shit, was I sexually abused, or how could I have thought of this? Or, you know, I don't know. It was scary for me. And I was so scary, I couldn't talk to my husband about it even. I mean, I would try, I would open my mouth, and then I couldn't get any words to come out. And then I met this guy, Stanley Siegel, who wrote this amazing book, Your Brain on Sex. I highly recommend it frequently to almost everyone that I talk to about this topic. And it's cited in my book. And he was a sex therapist in New York for, I don't know, 40 years. Really, really brilliant guy. And wrote this book. And it turns out, at least this is the theory, and it really seems to make sense to me in so many ways, that just in the same way that our subconscious uses our dream state to sort out our unresolved emotions, it also does that with unresolved emotions from our childhood when we become sexual, and turns them into this core of fantasies that really turns our crank. And it's not anything we have control over consciously, so that kind of lets us off the hook for whatever's there. But it does actually have this really remarkable healing mechanism, because what the subconscious is always trying to do is take painful material in the brain and turn it into something that we can be at peace with or get pleasure from, in the case of fantasies. And so, you know, it's not a straight line, right? Because it's our subconscious. And that's why somebody with an overbearing mother or an abandonment issue might have any number of fantasies that would be different than mine, right? But it seems like there is this connection. You know, one example he gives is this idea that this girl's brought up in a very strict religious family. And then, you know, as an adult, she has this crazy fantasy about having sex with a priest. She can't get out of her head. Her husband plays that out with her. There's this massive healing that happens, mm-hmm. you know, in ways that we can't explain. And so what I would say to you is that I really believe that, that this is true for everybody, and that many people don't have the courage to look in that direction. And some people actually do have the courage to look in that direction, but not actually connecting the dots to what they need to learn from that, and then even play it out even more extremely in dungeons or any number of 3D locations. And I actually really speak with caution about taking steps to make your fantasies real. You know, there are a few things my husband and I have discussed over time about potentially bringing in a third person or whatever, you know, is in my head, you know, a few things that I've told him. But we've never actually done it because I don't know what would happen in that room that would risk the safety I have with him. And the truth is, if I just think it, it's sexy enough. Mm-hmm. I get what I need from just thinking it. And I don't even have to tell him I'm thinking it. So anyway, yeah, I think there's a lot we need to learn about fantasy, and that there's a lot of peace we need to make about our sexual history as a humanity. And I think that individual fantasy work is one way that we can do that.
Yeah, having fantasies, one can look lots of different ways. And so I think sometimes we fall into the trap of trying to make our fantasies be a certain thing instead of just allowing them to be what they are. And that's kind of the witness process that you talk about in the book. And then also I love, like, we're allowed to let our fantasies stay in our head and to be this [S2] Totally. [S1] Fuel that we use to have this amazing pleasure experience and go on this journey either by ourselves or with someone else. And I think sometimes living out your fantasies can be a wonderful thing. And I think they sometimes can also be really disappointing. Like, I had a chance to live out a fantasy of mine around being watched, and it was kind of like, it was nowhere near as hot in my head.
No, I mean, it's like, I just want to say a lot of people have rape fantasies. A lot of people do. But to actually be raped is not like what happens in your fantasy, mm-hmm. right? So I would say that, whatever, we kind of watch that in Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of it and then actually somebody hitting you, not that great, you know? So I don't know. I'm not an expert on this, and there have been times in my many years of writing that I have tried to write about this topic, and it's such a slippery slope. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, that chapter took 5 rewrites,
yeah,
with really smart people helping me. And it's very hard to say what needs to be said without risking offending people.
Yeah.
And so I feel like people will maybe be offended by that chapter, or afraid or whatever, or angry. And there's really so much more to say about it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, we are at the end of our hour, and I would love it if you would share with everybody how they can stay in touch with you, find your products online, all that good stuff.
Yeah. So, goodcleanlove.com. We have a beautiful site. We have so much education on there. My blog is makinglovesustainable.com, and you can get it through Good Clean Love or just by going to Making Love Sustainable. And I write every week religiously about how to be a lover in your life. And my book, Sex That Works, was #1 yesterday on Amazon New Picks. So that was kind of exciting, and it's available today. And I have a website called wendystrugar.com that we just kind of fancied up, and it has like a free ebook on there, so people could download a little sample of the book that way. So yeah, and you know, I love to talk about sex, as you can see, and would love to do it again with you, Dawn, any day.
Yay.
And with anybody else who has a spot where they feel like that would be helpful, then I would love for them to get in touch and ask me.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Wendy. All of your wisdom and stories.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. And next time, let's start with gratitude.
Oh, I would love that.
Because we actually skipped that part, but
yeah.
I know we would really resonate on that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank everybody who tuned in. I will have all of Wendy's links at sexgetsreal.com for this episode. Be sure to grab a copy of the book and also ask for your library to carry it, so it's helpful to people who can't afford the book themselves. Check out all of Wendy's stuff. If you've got any thoughts or questions, please send them to me. You know I love hearing from you. And until next time, this is Dawn Sarah. Bye.